Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Newman, a host on this channel, and today we'll be talking to Sandra Mendiola Garcia about her recent book, Street Democracy, Vendors, Violence, and Public Space in Late 20th Century Mexico. Sandra, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, we're happy to have you. Sandra, I wonder if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Certainly. I was born and raised in Mexico, and then after my BA, I moved to Canada to do my MA, and then I got my PhD in Latin American history at Rutgers University, and I am currently a professor of Latin American history, Mexican history, at the University of North Texas in Denton. And yes, I love teaching, and I am very lucky that a lot of my students are Mexicans or Mexican-Americans, so it is really a great experience to be teaching to these students.
Wonderful. Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to this particular project?
Yes. So when I was doing my graduate school, my PhD, I really wanted to write a history about business women, small size business women, because I always was intrigued about women in Mexico really making a living and being able to, feed children, and despite all the economic crisis in Mexico. So I started researching at the municipal archive, at the city archive of the city of Puebla, and looking through records about women and businesses. And I found really not too many documents about it. But what I found were all these records about market women, women who had stalls in markets, in public markets. And there were not one or two, there were hundreds of them. And so I became very intrigued by these women, by these market vendors. Interestingly enough, as I was doing the research there in Puebla, the archive, the municipal archive, is right in downtown, the municipal palace, right in the heart of the city. And usually when there are marches or political events, a lot of these events take in downtown. So as I was researching about market women, I was listening outside the protest of a group of street vendors that had been very active in Puebla's politics. So I started thinking about street vendors and women, and so that's how the book came out, right? The idea of, at that point, the dissertation came out about kind of bringing together the lives of these women, which later also became a book about men and women vendors and their political activities.
Wonderful. That's such a fascinating story about how you came to this topic. So your book is set in late 20th century Puebla, and I wondered if to begin you could tell us a little bit about Puebla in that time period and the place of street vendors in the city in that era.
Yes. Okay. So Puebla is Mexico's fourth largest city. A lot of the history that is written, has written about Mexico, usually tends to focus on Mexico City or places like Oaxaca or cities in the Yucatan Peninsula, right? Which attract a lot of attention, Veracruz. But Puebla, you know, Puebla is a very important city, the most important city in the colonial period after Mexico City, yet, you know, hasn't received too much attention from historians. And, well, in the 1970s, Puebla was a city that was experiencing a re-emergence of industrialization, right? Puebla had been known as a textile center since the colonial period, but by the mid-1960s, a number of companies had established in Puebla, such as Volkswagen, the German automaker, Ilsa, which is a steel maker. So there was this new economic boom in Puebla. And one of the things that happens in this kind of situations is that the informal economy also takes place at the same time as industrialization, right? At least in developing countries. So, and of course, because a lot of people are migrating from rural areas to the cities, expecting to get jobs, etc. Right? So, obviously, not everybody can get jobs in the formal sector in industries or factories. So we see this wave of migrants from the countryside to Puebla in the 1960s and the 1970s. Now, Puebla is also known to be a very conservative city, a city that is very religious. A lot of the most conservative Catholic hierarchs, right, are in Puebla. And at the same time, the city housed at that period the university, the Autonomous University of Puebla, La Universidad Autónoma de Puebla, which was also going through an enormous change during the 1960s, 70s, right, in which the university was becoming much more radical, less conservative, and many students from many social backgrounds, especially people from poor social backgrounds, were entering the university. So I would characterize Puebla in the 1960s and 70s as a city that was going through a lot of changes. And in this sense, right, street vendors, are also on the rise, right, because all of these economic opportunities and the city's streets in downtown were quite active, right, and so during these decades, most street vendors were actually selling their wares in downtown streets at the heart of the city, especially surrounding two very important markets that were at the center of the city.
Could you tell us a little bit more about who these vendors are, you know, their background, where they're coming from?
Yes. So in the book, I cover from the 1970s to the mid-1990s. So during this period of time, the characteristics of vendors change, but towards the beginning of the period that I studied in the 1970s, a lot of these folks, as I mentioned, were migrants from small towns in the state of Puebla, but also people coming from the state of Oaxaca, people coming from Tlaxcala, some people coming from the countryside in Veracruz, so pretty much rural migrants coming from neighboring states that surround Puebla. Now, these street vendors were also born in Puebla, in the city of Puebla. So it was kind of an eclectic group. A lot of these folks are also the children of market vendors, people who had stalls in market. Now, in terms of gender, half or more than 50% of the street vending population were women, and also children as young as 14, 13 years old who already had their stalls. Although photographic evidence tells us that there were even younger children working on the streets selling wares with their parents. So it was a very eclectic group of my street vendors.
And could you tell us too about sort of what draws people to this work, vending on the street? Some of the appealing parts of this very difficult work?
Yes. As you know, and people who have visited Mexico, street vending is omnipresent, right? Everywhere you go, there are street vendors. And part of the reason why is because entry costs are low. Pretty much anybody can start selling wares on the streets, not necessarily downtown streets, but on every street in neighborhoods, or selling wares in hospitals or outside of schools. Vendors that you don't necessarily see, right, but that they are vending, selling stuff, right, home to home, knocking on doors, I mentioned in offices. Selling food, right? Selling tortas in public administrative offices. And again, right? Is that an easy way of not having great amounts of capital to invest? Anybody can basically start from very little and be able to sell, right? So that is part of the reason, right? Low entry costs. Now, in the case of women, street vending also allowed women to bring their children to work, right? In the absence of affordable childcare, in the absence of having family members who could potentially take care of children, this kind of work allows people to bring their children along, and also teach these children the trade. Right, or use these children to sell as well. And so that's another factor that makes street vending so appealing. And of course, in Mexico, where, you know, economic crises are a constant, right, and surviving economically is so difficult in the absence of jobs, well, there are really no other chances, no other opportunities, even if working on the streets is not easy in terms of, you know, being harassed by police officers or by just people, or even the danger of being on the streets and being hit by cars or by buses, trucks. Well, there is no other way, right? That's kind of the only way in which people can make a living.
Thank you. That really tells us a lot about the complexity of informality. So in your book, you talk about how these street vendors form a union. But before we talk about that very fascinating story, could you tell us a little bit about the history of unions in 20th century Mexico, and why it's so important to look at independent unions like the one that you study?
Yeah, so unions in Mexico, whether they are unions of workers, industrial workers, or peasant unions, For the most part, especially in the second half of the 20th century, most unions were co-opted by the ruling party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, the Partido Revolucionario Institucional. These unions, as part of their cooptation, usually had leaders who had to agree with the party, with employers, and on many occasions didn't work for the best interest of the rank and file members. Not always, but that was for the most part, generally speaking. Your listeners know, these kind of unions were known as chattel unions, right? Unions that were corrupted, who work on behalf of employers, or in this case, on behalf of the party of the PRI. The union that I study is a union that was formed in 1973 by street vendors, which I think it's quite a unique way of organizing, right? Because this is a union of folks in the informal economy, and these people, these vendors, were independent of the PRI. They were never co-opted. They were never affiliated to the PRI or to any political party, for that matter. Why is this important? Because these kinds of unions really challenge the state, right? Challenge the party by not agreeing with the party or with authorities in Mexico. Right? So union independence really allows street vendors to have many opportunities, right? So, for example, because they were independent, they were able to elect their own leaders. And the leaders, of course, represented the interest of their rank and file members of the street vendors. Women could participate in union activities. They could be elected as leaders. Women and men, right, could dissent from authorities. So this provided kind of an alternative of organizing, right? A more grassroots organizing that had nothing to do with the political party. And the PRI could not use these street vendors as pawns of the state. Sometimes the street vendors, especially in Mexico City, are used by the government, by the PRI, by the state, for political purposes, right? To occupy streets, to go to marches, to attend rallies, official rallies, etc. Whereas these folks in Puebla, this particular union, the Unión Popular de Vendedores Ambulantes, remained quite independent. Now, of course, this independence also meant that the state was always very aggressive against them, and we can talk about that in a little while.
Thank you so much for laying that out for us. So maybe you could tell us the particular story of how this independent union of the vendors came about, and if you could say something about the role of university students in that process. I think that would be very interesting for the listeners.
Yes, so the Unión Popular de Vendedores Ambulantes, the popular union of street vendors, which I'm going to refer as the UPVA, formed in 1973. And the reason why these vendors began organizing so effectively was because street vendors had connections, very close connections, to very young university students. And when I say university students, I mean students who were part of the university system in Puebla, which included high school students. So we're talking about very, very young students that were on the streets on a regular basis because the university was in downtown. Downtown, again, was very a popular area of town with the university in downtown. And so there was this constant flow of students on the street. The street vendors and the students actually had some commonalities, that had to do with their class status. A lot of the students during this period were working class, recent immigrants from rural areas. The university at that time, in the 1970s, did not have enough spaces for all these students, right? There were no classrooms, right? So, for example, some of the students that were connected to the street vendors had to take classes in chemistry labs, right? The chemistry labs would be their classrooms, right? There would be no blackboards, no seats where they could write. They would be just in these chemistry classrooms because the university didn't have the infrastructure to have all these new students. So these students actually began to also protest on the streets because they want the university to give them classrooms to provide with professors, with books, with a more updated library. These students, right, are kind of mingling with street vendors on the streets kind of naturally. At the same time, the street vendors are getting in touch with the students because they are selling them food, they are selling them wares. Some of these folks are actually dating, right? So I met students and vendors who, you know, began dating at that time. They began making these connections. Now, the students that I was able to talk with, or former students, were on the left. Right? They identify themselves as Maoists, and they saw in the street vendors kind of an opportunity for them to carry out their own political activities. Right? So the street vendors want to defend themselves from the fact that the police is constantly harassing them, constantly chasing them from the streets, right? Taking their merchandise away. And again, right, these are very poor people who are trying to make a living, whose merchandise is the most precious things that they have. And when they lose these things, well, there's no food for them for that day or for subsequent days. So the vendors see in the students potential allies, and that's how they began organizing together. The students actually provide with political tools, with the strategies of organizing, and you know, that's how the union actually is formed. In 1972.
So in the book, the theme of direct democracy comes up often, and I wondered if you could speak a little bit about what that means and how for the union, really maybe surprising strategies like theater and other forms of direct democracy, how that played into the practices of this union.
Yes, one of the most fascinating aspects of researching this union was precisely what you mentioned, that these connections with the students allow street vendors to get ideas, innovative ideas of organizing, right? So for example, at the time in the early 1970s, the university in Puebla, the state university in Puebla where these students came from, were hosting classes of Chicano theater, right? So the students are being taught Chicano theater, Luis Valdez plays, so this kind of theater is theater in which, you know, ordinary people play, make plays, theater plays that represent the struggles of the working class, right? And So there are all these workshops in which students are involved. And some students tell the vendors, right, about this kind of theater. And the vendors who were very enthusiastic about it say, well, why don't we do our own theater play? And then they began forming their play and creating their play, which they called Street Vendors, Vendedores Ambulantes. And it was the same vendors who are acting, and they acted on corners of streets, in markets, in schools, at stoplights, right? They play an act, and in those plays, they basically are expressing to a larger public the plights of vendors, right? Specifically, how police officers are taking away their merchandise, and also how some police officers are harassing women, right? Sexually harassing women. So it is. It was just fascinating to see how these rather unusual connections play out in the organizing and in the union activities. But again, right, I want to emphasize that the union was able to carry out these activities because of their independence from the PRI. Another thing that the street vendors did in collaboration with the university students was the making of a film. In 1973-1974, one of the professors of theater, very young professor of, not of theater, I'm sorry, of film at the State University, he decided to kind of produce a documentary, a very short documentary. And asked the vendors if they wanted to kind of be on it, and just through this film express once more the problems that street vendors faced on the streets. And so the street vendors were very enthusiastic, and they began doing this project, which ended up being or the film itself actually ended up in Germany, winning the best prize, one of the winner of the prizes for best short films. These were unexpected things, right? No vendors ever went to Germany or anything like that, but just knowing that their production had reached an international audience was tremendously amazing for the vendors. Now, sometimes when we think about the present and we think about social media and we think about, you know, people really, you know, doing all sorts of videos, right? It's so easy right now. But for the 1970s, for the early 1970s to do this and to reach an international audience, was it an achievement, right? Especially as these street vendors were people with no formal education, right? If at all, they went to a few years of elementary school, and they didn't have any formal education. Some of the vendors were illiterate, especially the women. So having these forms of communication were instrumental in the union and political activities.
And so these various forms of resistance that you describe in the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, zucchini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I guess the result is that they're met with repression from the state at various levels. So I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about this and, you know, also about the ways that you had to look for various sources to tell the whole story and fill the gaps left by archival materials.
Yes. So I'm going to start with the second part of your question. When I began the project, I never imagined that some of my primary sources would come from the documents coming from the secret police in Mexico, right? From the documents that the administration of Vicente Fox declassified at the beginning of his tenure as president. And this document basically came from two agencies, right? One of them was the Dirección Federal de Seguridad, the Security Directorate. And these sources, as I mentioned, had been not available to the public or to researchers, or if they were very, very limited, of the limitations were quite big. But anyway, since they opened these documents, historians have realized how many organizations, political parties, individuals were actually spied on, or the state kept track of their activities. However, I never thought that the street vendors that I was studying in Puebla, a group of poor illiterate folks, would have a file and several files, many files, in this archive, right? This was housed at the Archivo General de la Nación in Mexico City. So it was just an eye-opening experience. Just to get to these files, hundreds and hundreds of pages that the state, the federal government actually had on these street vendors of Puebla, and how the secret police, these informants, basically traced the activities of the vendors, the political activities of the vendors, almost on a daily basis, and following their leaders, much more so than the rank and file. It was also very interesting to note that this document didn't talk too much about women, right? Even if I knew that women were some of the most active members of the union, women actually are not mentioned in these intelligence reports, right? And when women are referred into these documents, they are referred as the lover of a leader, or the wife of one leader, etc. While I knew from interviews and from other documents at the local level that these women were not the lovers or the wives. I mean, they could be, but that's beyond the point. The fact is that these women were organizing, they were very active, but yet the state was, or these informants, these particular informants, were not paying too much attention to these women, because of course these men, which I'm assuming were men, who were spies, who were informants, didn't see women as political actors, are only a few of them are mentioned, are ever mentioned. But anyway, the reason why I began looking at these records is because I knew from oral interviews and from, again, other local sources that vendors had faced a lot of repression. And one of the main themes in the book is that a street vendor also faced the violence that the state inflicted upon other folks that we know of, like peasants or industrial workers or who were active politically in Mexico, right? So it's not only about people in the formal economy or in guerrilla movements who were infiltrated, right? People like street vendors were also infiltrated and they were also heavily, heavily repressed by the state. And yes, as you mentioned when you were asking the question, there were many layers of repression and violence. Right? For one, vendors were usually beaten by authorities, men, women, illegally detained, especially the leaders, tortured, disappear for a few days, in which families didn't know where these folks were, their whereabouts. There was a case of a child who went missing, and most of the vendors that I interviewed claimed that it was the state police, or somebody in the government level that had kidnapped this kid because the parents were some of the main leaders of the organization, of the union. Of course, I was never able to find any evidence in the intelligence reports. There was a lot of violence against these vendors. The main leader of the UPVA, Simitrio, was incarcerated several times for over a decade in Puebla, and also ended up in federal security prisons. So, you know, it was very interesting, and of course very sad, right, to see that people such as street vendors could also be as heavily repressed as they were.
And I wonder, you know, in your fifth chapter, you call that chapter From La Victoria to Walmart. And I wondered if you could sort of explain the story that title refers to and connect that to the recent history of neoliberalism in Mexico.
Yeah, so that chapter is one of my favorite chapters. Because I began thinking about the most recent changes happening in recent Mexican history, particularly Mexico's turn towards neoliberalism, which started in the early 1980s. But I really wanted to see, to go beyond what we already know, which is, you know, the closing of state-led enterprises or the reduction of workers in certain areas of the economy. One of the things that I wanted to investigate was how did neoliberalism play a role in the redefinition of public space? And also, of course, the fight against unions during this period of time. So, in 1986, a group of businessmen, local authorities in Puebla actually applied to the UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, for Puebla City's downtown to become part of the World Heritage Site list. So the folks claim that Puebla had colonial buildings, 19th century buildings belonging to the Porfirian regime that had immense historical value, etc. And that, that the UNESCO should, you know, have Puebla as part of this World Heritage Site recognition. In the application, which I was able to locate, these people, the city boosters, so to speak, mentioned that they have already begun to clean the cities of Puebla, right? To preserve, to rescue, right? That's the word that they use, to rescue the city center, right? And of course, what they mean by rescuing is by rescuing it from the working class, from the poor, right? From people like street vendors who are selling on the streets, who are using public spaces in downtown. There was a very big market in the heart of the city, which was La Victoria Market, El Mercado de la Victoria, which was a the market itself goes back to the colonial times, right? In the 19th century, it became a little bit more structured, and then during the Porfiriato, it became a market, like an enclosed market. And it was one of the most important markets in the state, right? Where people from all over the place, from many parts of the state of Puebla, came to sell their wares. One anthropologist actually said it was like a living museum, right? Where you can find live animals, food, fruits, vegetables, and whatever you wanted. But of course, right, the people who shopped in this market, who sold in this market, were poor people or lower class people, working class people, maids, you know, the lower classes, the popular classes, right? And these people, together with the street vendors that actually sold their products outside the market, were, in the words of these boosters, right, dirtying the streets, right? Their presence is chaotic. Their presence makes the city look bad, and they need to rescue, you know, the beauty of the city, the beauty of the streets. Actually, the market, La Victoria Market, these boosters argue, was a monument, right, that belonged to the Porfiriato, and that the market itself had to be rescued. So what the authorities did, the city authorities did, was to actually expel all the market vendors, right? These are stall owners who had been there for generations. They were actually kicked out of the market because the city government was going to to clean the market, to fix the electrical fixtures, to kind of remodel it. And they actually mentioned that the marketeers could come back at the end of all these projects. All of this was never happened. Right? What happened is that the marketeers were expelled by the city authority. The local government actually leased for free the market to a big foundation in Puebla, a private foundation in Puebla, and the market actually was remodeled by this private foundation, and it later became a shopping mall that opened up again in the early 1990s, and one of the, well, there were many stores, right? But two of them were particularly interesting for me. One of them was Suburbia, which is a department store. And the other one was a restaurant called Vips. And many of your listeners probably recognize the name Vips because it's a chain of restaurants that at that time belonged to Walmart, right? Walmart of Mexico. So that's why I named the chapter from La Victoria to Walmart, because this space went from being community oriented, working class market, right, to a semi-private, private mall, shopping mall that housed Walmart, right, or two stores that belong to Walmart. And for me, that was very symbolic of the neoliberal turn, right, in which public spaces stopping public spaces and became privately owned spaces, right? So today, what used to be that important market full of people, full of products that came from the countryside, local products, local produce, food, etc., now has become a mall, a lower-end mall, because it's not a high-end mall, but a lower-end mall in which you find shops with Chinese-made products, beauty shops, restaurants like Vips that you can find in any part of Mexico. Yeah, so that's how this chapter basically tell us a different aspect of what the neoliberal turn meant or has meant in Mexico, right? And a lot of these changes have come slowly, right? And sometimes people don't even notice them. So that's also an important aspect of the chapter.
Yes, and we really get to see how neoliberalism plays out in a very specific space. And I think that helps make it less abstract as well. So your book does not end there, though, after these stories about state repression first, and then a story about displacement in these economic and political shifts at the end of the 20th century. But you actually show that this union, the UPVA, has survived up until the present, I believe. So could you tell us a little bit about how the union changes and adapts following these changes, these setbacks?
Yeah, so 1986 was an important year because market vendors are displaced, and together with them, street vendors are also displaced. They are kicked out from downtown areas, and they end up in the outskirts of the streets in newly built public markets that were very cheap, were very badly designed, away from the city center where people were used to shop, and sometimes not even public transportation reached these places. Right? So one of my arguments is that these vendors, these street vendors, were displaced to these areas to not only because boosters wanted to clean the cities, but also because authorities want to dismantle the union, right? The street vendor union, which by the mid-1980s had about 10,000 members. So city authorities, I argue, were worried about this union, about the strength of the independent union. So they thought, okay, if we separate these vendors, we send them throughout the market, we make them market owners rather than street vendors, well, the union is going to disappear. And the union is going to be weakened. But that didn't happen. The union was able, the union leadership and the rank and file were able to survive. A lot of the members actually ended up in one market, in the outskirts of the city, which by now it's not the outskirts anymore. And they continue their activities. They have to refashion, reimagine, reconstruct the union And by doing so, they also open the union to taxi drivers, to other people, and also reach out to neighborhoods, to tenants in certain neighborhoods. So the union, even if it lost members in the transition from downtown to these outskirts, these markets in the outskirts, we're able to actually incorporate other kinds of people. So they continue selling, although it was a very hard path of survival, but they continue to sell in these markets. They continue their organizing. The repression continues. A few years ago, for example, the daughter of one of the main leaders was killed by these men who entered the offices, the headquarters of the union, and shot the daughter of the main leader and killed her. So repression continues. Other forms of repression, I'm not quite sure how to call this, but this particular market where the UPVA members sell their products has been actually surrounded by supermarkets. So they face competition. So I guess it's economic violence here that I'm talking about, in which now vendors have, or this union of vendors have to not only worry about police or about authorities threatening now to close the market, but also trying to compete against Walmart, against this large chain of supermarkets that sometimes, you know, offer credit to people. Or just the simple competition of the supermarkets. So that's kind of how the struggle continues. But one of the most fascinating aspects of the current situation of the union is that the membership and the union leaders use social media. So stories that we didn't know before are told in on social media, the political activities. Sometimes they stream live on Facebook. They post photographs, documents, right? So in some way now, the union is, I don't know, willingly or unwillingly creating a different kind of archive, right?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for walking us through your book. And before we conclude, I would love to hear, and I'm sure the listeners would as well, about what your current project is. What are you working on now?
Yes. So I am working in a very, very different project. I am investigating silver miners in central Mexico, in Pachuca and Real del Monte. I just finished a draft of an article about a 1985 strike of miners in which all of these 3,500 miners showed up naked to their workplaces in 1985. And they were asking the company, which at that time was a state-led company, to provide for better equipment and for safety equipment and clothes to work in these mines in the state of Hidalgo. So this new project is going to explore not only the struggles that miners had to go at the workplace throughout the 20th century, but also I want to explore the cultural side of these miners. These two communities that I study now are being challenged because the silver mining industry ended in the region. So they are reimagining the economy, restructuring the economy, and in many cases, they are doing so through tourism. Right? So I'm currently writing about tourism and food. This region is famous about for their pastes, which are the Mexicanized version of the British pasties. And so, again, right, it's how communities have to transition once more and during the neoliberal turn and move from heavily industrialized labor to tourism and the service sector and the food industry.
Sounds like a great project.
So that's part of Garment Home. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Looking forward to those articles. So just again, we've been speaking with Sandra Mendiola Garcia about her book, Street Democracy, Vendors, Violence, and Public Space in Late 20th Century Mexico. Sandra, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really nice talking with you.